I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Well, thanks everybody for coming to this, the last of our three Two Cultures in Conversation events. I'm delighted to be joined. My name's Neil Denny of Little Atoms, I should say. I'm delighted to be joined by Naomi Alderman and Adam Rutherford, who are directly to my right, to your left, if you're looking from the front. What we're going to do is, Naomi and Adam have both got fantastic books out in the last few months. They're both at the back and available to purchase for money, as is the last two editions of the Little Atoms magazine, if you're so inclined. I'm going to talk to each of them in turn, I think, for about 10 minutes about the books. And then we're going to talk about some of the ideas that come out of those books. And that will very quickly degenerate into us talking about sci-fi movies, which we're all into. So I think that's probably where this is going to go, if that's your thing. So, Naomi, first of all, let's talk about The Power.
Hello.
Your novel. What's it about?
Okay. I wish I had a copy to hold up now, but it's at the back with the red cover with the hand on it. The Power is about what happens when all of a sudden almost all the women in the world develop the power to electrocute people at will. Adam has been enjoying my book. Everything changes. It doesn't take too long for a lot of things to be quite different. So it follows four characters. There's Roxy, who is the daughter of a crime family in London, and she had thought that her three older brothers would inherit, but she starts to get an idea that she might want it instead. There is Tunde, who is a male journalist. That's what we call journalists if they are men. There's journalists and male journalists. The women in the room understood that joke. It's great. He decides he wants to write a book chronicling the great change in the world, and so he goes travelling and gets himself into trouble. You know, boys getting themselves into trouble when they should just keep themselves nice at home. There is Ali, who is kind of at the start of the book, is living in a foster family and is being abused, and she very rapidly deals with that and then goes on to found her own religion. And there is Margot, who is a mayor of a town in New England, and she has an idea for how big business could get involved in helping these girls. And we all know how public-private military partnerships work in America. And when I wrote this book, I rewrote it in 2015. When I wrote it, I thought the idea that you might end up with the president of the United States who might really threaten nuclear war was a bit far-fetched. But unfortunately, events have proved me distressingly wrong about that. And now it's got a sort of apocalyptic tone to it, that book, because I don't actually think that women are nicer than men and would just be lovely if we could electrocute people at will.
I was going to say, the book's also a bit zeitgeisty in that some of the, I won't say heroes, but some of the people that perform like quite important functions in the plot are men's rights activists.
Oh, yes. Well, I have the benefit, maybe, of having been a woman working in the games industry for the past few years. So whilst the idea of men's rights activists and fucking Milo might be brand new to many people, to women working in the games industry, this bunch of loose stool water buckets have been plaguing us for a while. There was a campaign called Gamergate a couple of years ago whilst I was working on the novel, which was basically, wouldn't it be nice to harass some women who work in games until they could no longer leave their houses? An amazing thing happened to a woman that I know who works in games, where some men's rights activists got annoyed with her, so they posted adverts on Craigslist around the world, around the country, with her home address on it, saying, "I have a rape fantasy. I want people to break into my house and rape me. And if I say no, don't stop, because that's my fantasy." It was for the novel. It was a benefit to have been, as it were, exposed to some of them.
Do you get the sense that your novel's a little bit unrealistic now that all this stuff really exists in the world?
I mean, I'm getting the sense that novel didn't go far enough, man. Just like, yeah, you can't really go wrong. You can't really overestimate the horribleness of some people. That is the problem. It only takes a few to make us all frightened.
I mean, you mentioned earlier that it isn't like, you know, women are much nicer and fluffier, and therefore the world will be a better place. Sorry about that, microphones. Can you hear me okay? The world would be a better place if microphones worked. The world would be a better place if, you know, women were in charge and everything, and that's not how the book pans out. And, you know, things actually, you know, get worse and worse and worse until it ends, which we're obviously not going to talk about how it ends, with, you know, something of a big event. Mm-hmm. But everything that happens in the book is actually something that is really happening somewhere.
Yes. So sometimes interviewers have said to me, so this is a dystopia. And what I say about it is, there is not a single thing that happens to a man in this book that isn't happening to a woman right now, today, somewhere in the world. So they work out how to do a form of penis curbing, which is burning out some nerves at the base of the penis so that a man can only get an erection if a woman gives him an electric shock, and it will always hurt him to come. And if that is really, really horrifying to you, that is what female genital mutilation does. And that has happened to women living in London right now. So, yeah, if this book is set in a dystopia, then we live in a dystopia. Sorry, that was a lot suddenly. But, people get, like, I think particularly blokes have been a bit horrified reading the book and just sort of look at me as if, how could you write these things? I'm like, have you really never maybe thought about what it might be like to live in a world where there's just casual, constant threats of violence to women as a woman? But I think the answer is no. Like, it's a very different thing to see a gun pointed at somebody else's head and go, oh, that's terrible, than it is when it's pointed at your forehead. That just feels different.
Tell us about the electric shock thing. How does it actually work?
Ah, so I actually did some research. In fact, I made a programme for Science Stories on Radio 4 about electric eels. And a lot of the stuff that I couldn't put into the programme ended up in the novel, because electric eels are amazing. They have, electric eels have an organ, the organ of electricity. Basically, it's a set of membranes and some muscle where they push certain electrons through a semi-permeable membrane, and then you release them sort of explosively all in one go, and that causes an electric shock. I'm looking at you because you're a scientist.
You're looking at me for support. Yeah. And I got no idea.
Yeah, it's like sodium ions. Like sodium ions? I think it's sodium ions. It's essentially the same thing as in the axons in your brain.
Yes.
Yes. Anyone here know what goes through a semipermeable membrane in the axons in your brain?
Well, lots of things, but it could be sodium ions. It could be a sodium.
Yeah, I think it's Na+. So they do that with their organ of electricity. And a discharge, if you were to stand in a swimming pool and a fully charged adult electric eel were to discharge, a full discharge from an electric eel would kill up to 5 people. So, yeah. So I give women in this book an organ of electricity across the collarbone, which would make it probably longer and sort of fatter than the ones that electric eels have. And so different women have different amounts of electricity, which seemed reasonable. And you could, if the strongest people can kill a bunch of people. And it does all basically make sense how that works. I did enough research that it makes sense. Other things that electric eels can do, they can do a form of electrolocation. So they send out electric waves, like small pulses, into the water, and so they can tell where things are. And they can do a sort of remote control of their prey fish. So if they're looking for a prey fish in, you wouldn't call it undergrowth underwater, would you? Like rocks and plants and so on underwater. They can send out a controlled electric burst which makes their muscles twitch, the prey fish's muscles twitch, so they can see where the prey is. And they can do a thing that confuses them so that they think that they are swimming away, but in fact they are swimming towards the mouth of the electric eel. So it's super cool. We don't really even know all the things they can do yet.
So The organ that starts through this, the skein, yes, as you call it, is a thing that it's not just appeared, it's probably been present in these women all the time, but and it's only loosely speculated about in the book. Perhaps some sort of pollution or something has caused this to develop.
Yeah, so I used a slightly debunked theory called the aquatic ape theory, which is, you probably have heard. So it's a nice theory. There's not a lot of evidence for it, but, you know, it's nice enough for a novel, which is that the reason that, for example, human babies are born quite fat and able to swim and with them, it's what's it called, vernix on their skin, sort of waxy substance on their skin. And the reason that we have much less hair than other great apes in our bodies is because at one point we went through an aquatic or a semi-aquatic phase in our evolution where we were either living on a seashore, which is probable, or living in the water, which is much less probable. Much less.
Adam's being very polite.
Yeah, you don't think there was a point where human beings had gills then?
There was, but they weren't human beings then, they were fish. it was about 450 million years ago.
So, you know, I did the thing. I did the disclaimer. I said it's basically debunked, it's fun.
I got no problem with it at all. I mean, aquatic ape is not a good scientific idea. In fact, it's not even a singular scientific idea. I can talk about aquatic ape all night if you want.
But it's cute. It's cute.
But no, we're not going to do that. But what I do want you to talk about, though, perhaps for a moment...
You talk about something.
..is epigenetics, because this is this not epigenetics?
Oh, yes, do talk about epigenetics.
Oh, must I? Must I? Well, go on, then ask me a question.
Well, go on, is this not some form of epigenetics, something that's dormant, that gets sort of like reawakened by sort of external stimulus?
Well, sort of, yeah. I mean, well, who's familiar with what epigenetics means? Okay, so it's a... You can read a piece about epigenetics in issue two.
Should we pause while everyone does that?
About 10 minutes.
Yeah, we'll have 10 minutes of silent reading.
So epigenetics is the phenomenon in biology which is literally the modification of DNA, because your DNA over one's life does not change. The DNA that you're born with is the DNA that you'll die with minor modifications according to, you know, mutations if you get things like cancer. But epigenetics is one of the mechanisms by which your DNA is expressed differentially across, you know, from conception to death. And it's one of a variety of mechanisms by which your genes are modified. So they're expressed at the right time and place, because we start as a single cell, and after a few hours, we're multiple cells, which are mostly identical to each other. But by the time you're born, you consist of trillions of cells, which are with hundreds of different cell types. Now, epigenetics is one of the mechanisms by which those cells get turned into the difference between a cell in the retina and some bone or a blood cell or whatever. The reason I roll my eyes when epigenetics comes up is because it's become enormously fashionable in the last few years to talk about epigenetics as if it was something both revolutionary and new. And it's neither of those things. It's a very interesting and not insignificant part of normal biology. But it isn't revolutionary and isn't new and it isn't unique. It's one of many mechanisms by which what I've just described, how genes are turned on and off. It's one of many mechanisms that exist to do that. But, you know, science is... It is prone to fashions, massively prone to fashions, not just in the popular press, how we talk about new discoveries, but also... in terms of how grants are funded, what is popular attracts more grants, and I don't think epigenetics is not important. I just don't think it's that interesting.
I think Fair it sounds enough. Amazingly interesting. I think you should do a whole book on it.
There's a chapter in my book at the back about that.
Reasonably priced at the back of the room.
Well, before we get to Adam's book, just one more thing about the power. And Naomi, I can remember when we talked years ago about your book, The Liar's Gospel, another amazing novel by Naomi, which you should also get.
Thank you so much.
That was a historical novel mm-hmm. about a imagined life of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And obviously that involved like a hell of amount of research before you got anywhere near actually writing the book. Mm-hmm. So beyond obviously researching the things like the electric eels, how do you go about researching a speculative novel?
Yeah, actually you can. Okay, so I read a lot of stuff about organised crime, which is really interesting because it seemed to me that, my thesis, I know a novel is not supposed to have a thesis, but my novels always do have theses. And it seems like they've done all right and people like them. So I feel like it's okay that I start off with a theme usually rather than starting off with characters. Anyway, that's just my own insecurity talking about how a real writer would write. So my thesis is that the capacity for violence and the capacity to cause pain is what lies at the root of a lot of the gender differences that we see in the world. And so I thought hard about where in the world the capacity for violence translates most quickly into other forms of power. So power is fungible. You can turn different kinds of power into other different kinds of power. You can turn money into political power, as apparently in the American election. You can turn political power into religious power. You can turn religious power into like control over media. You know, you can use one to get another. And it seemed to me that starting out with crime is a good place where the capacity to hurt someone really a lot easily turns into cash. Which can then be turned into almost anything else. So I read Misha Glenny's written some brilliant books about organised crime, particularly in Eastern Europe, and how that works actually. And it's brilliant. I can't remember the name of the book, but it's Misha Glenny's book about organised crime in Eastern Europe talks about actually how the oligarchs became that rich, which is basically the Soviet Union collapsed not in an orderly way, but in bits. So there might still be a bit which was allowing a certain company to buy oil from the state regulators at fixed prices, but then the other bit, which was selling it on to the open market, was totally not state controlled anymore, so you could buy it at a very low price from the government and sell it at whatever was the market price, and that is how a bunch of people became extraordinarily wealthy. And there's various other things like that going on. It's amazing. I also, in a certain way, history can be quite useful. So knowing what tends to happen in revolutions and wars. I remember in the Arab Spring, there was this sort of, like, there were people talking about it going, oh, this is amazing, this is wonderful, look what's happened in Egypt, they've toppled their government and the military have taken over. And there was a kind of moment of, like, excitement. And I, having read a lot of history in my time, was looking at this going, is this something that we're pleased about when a military junta takes over? Does that usually work out okay? Maybe it's better than the previous thing, maybe not. The more history you read, the more you know about the really terrible things people do to each other. If you really want to read something much worse than anything I have written, go and get a book about what happened in the Belgian Congo. Like, you know, at that point, you just, you know, the idea that there will be things that are unimaginable that people could do to each other. No, there's nothing. And also, I guess, my whole life has been a research for writing about invented religions. I grew up a very Orthodox Jew, and I remain fascinated by weird religions.
Well, there's a lot more to go into there, but we are gonna move on.
As a former Orthodox Jew, are you allowed to describe Orthodox Judaism as a weird religion?
I've got an arrangement with God. I don't bother him, he doesn't bother me.
I'm not going to argue with that.
So, Adam, a brief history of everyone who ever lived. People will be delighted to know that it's not 10 foot tall with a little paragraph about literally everybody who ever lived. What is the idea?
Yeah, well, there is a small caveat in that. I mean, it's not an A to Z. I have had complaints from people, including on Amazon.
Where am I? I'm not mentioned.
I went through the index and I'm not in there. It's not a phone book, dude. But the premise is that it's a history book. So it's great that we're talking about history books, because I, as a geneticist, as a scientist, spent a lot of the last few years reading history, which is new for me, well, since GCSE history. But the premise is that in the last few years, sort of 10 years maximum, but really only the last 5 or 6 years, DNA has been added to the set of historical tools, of sources that historians can use to reinterpret the past. And it has been in several fields within history, and I include prehistory and paleoanthropology and anthropology within that. Some of these areas have been utterly revolutionized, completely transformed by the addition of DNA to these more traditional forms of understanding the past. Other areas have verified what we already knew. Others have challenged, and so that's the idea. It's a history book where DNA is the source.
So one of the things that you challenge right at the beginning, everybody in this room, even if they didn't study science at a particularly high level, will be familiar with a guy called Rudolf Zallinger's diagram called the March of Progress, which I have. I probably should have done a slide, but I've reproduced here. It looks like this. Now, beyond the obvious of the version that I've reproduced, Adam, what's up with this?
Well, the one you're holding there has Homer Simpson in various monkey-like forms before he becomes the final Homer Simpson. And everyone's familiar with this image where you have sort of small lemur-type, monkey-type things on the left-hand side, and they gradually become bigger and more upright and eventually end up in a the ultimate form of Homo sapiens, which is a white-bearded man carrying a spear.
All right. A mediocre white man.
Yeah. and also they've all got their right legs in front of their left legs,
right,
so you can't see their genitals as well. Which, as I say in the book, is a slightly, you know, given that this whole idea is about the transmission of biological information from one generation to the next over evolutionary time, being prudish about your cock and balls is possibly not the most progressive way to think scientifically. Anyway, I got two issues with it. One is that it implies, well, it suggests that there is direction to our evolution, and that the ultimate form of in our evolutionary trajectory is both Homo sapiens and a white bearded man with a spear. Now, this is apart from being politically peculiar, it's just scientifically illiterate that there is no direction to evolution in any form it takes. Humans are no more or less advanced than any organism that exists. We don't talk about higher or lower organisms these days because, you know, we've existed for a much shorter period of time in our current form than, well, pretty much all other organisms on Earth, and the organisms that have lasted the longest and will outlast us, outnumber us, and outmass us, outweigh us, are bacteria. They are the dominant forms of life on Earth. So the first problem is that there is no direction to evolution. We are simply the product of time and chance. The second issue I have with it is a more scientific problem, which is that as a result of looking at DNA and using DNA, particularly ancient DNA that has been retrieved from bones that have been in the ground or in caves for tens of thousands of years now, we now have really no picture, no cohesive structure to human evolution. Mm-hmm. And when we were growing up, we had these nice branching trees which said that there was Homo erectus here and there was Australopithecus here and Homo heidelbergensis, and there's this led to Homo neanderthalensis, and blah blah blah. And that just there's no picture now. We now know that. I mean, I fondly describe this as a sort of million year clusterfuck, because what the DNA says is for the last few hundred thousands of years, what we used to call separate species like Homo sapiens, Homo neanderthalensis, and now we've discovered a couple of new species for which we have either no or very few bones. Interbreeding occurs on many occasions between at least those four species. So, you know,
What are the other two?
Well, so one is a character called the Denisovans. Mm-hmm. And we have a single molar and the fingertip bone from a juvenile female. Yeah. Now, that's not enough to categorize a species which is done morphologically, historically.
Literally just one tooth and the fingertip.
Yeah, from a teenage girl. But it was enough to get the full genome out of. Mm-hmm. And this was 2010 and 11. And by getting the full genome, you then compare it to Homo sapiens, our own DNA. And it's too different for it to be considered the same species. Mm-hmm. Same happens with Homo neanderthalensis.
You can find DNA from that in humans.
But you can find DNA from the Denisovans in humans, especially the further east you go.
Right.
So the only samples we have for Denisovans are in Siberia, mm-hmm. in Denis's cave, in fact. So that's where the Denisovan names come. He was a...
A bloke who had a cave.
He was a hermit.
Yeah.
An eremite who lived in a cave for a few years in the 19th century, and now he's got a whole species named after him. It's funny how these things pan out.
That's not what he wanted. He just wanted a quiet life.
Yeah, he wanted to be left alone. Although, weirdly, that's precisely where Neanderthal's name come from as well. So Joachim Neander changed his name from Neumann, mm-hmm. which means new man.
Yeah.
He changed it to Neander, which means new man, but in Greek.
Right.
And then he went and hid in a cave in the Neander Valley outside Dusseldorf. Do I mean Dusseldorf? Yes, Dusseldorf.
Yeah.
And he hid there to contemplate and to be religious. And that was the site of the first Neanderthal
bones
discovered.
But it wasn't these hermits who found those bones.
No, both the hermit stories are completely irrelevant to the science. I think there's a nice parallel.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose... OK, I've got a theory for you here. I suppose if you are a hermit looking for a lovely cave, you might pick a cave that humans or human-like species have previously looked at and gone, oh, this is lovely.
Yeah, he's picked a good cave.
Yeah.
He has. No, in both, I think that's very good. I don't know anything about the Dusseldorf cave, Neanderthal cave, because it was destroyed in the 19th century by miners and re-excavated where they found bones subsequently, but it doesn't exist anymore. But the Denisova's cave is why are we talking about caves
again? I'm asking you about caves.
The Denisova cave still exists and has been occupied by thousands of species for thousands of years. It's really nice. It's a nice cave. I mean, it's got a sort of riverfront view.
You put it on Right Move and you...
Listen, I'm not just plugging the book here, but I describe it using the language of estate agents in the book. It has a spacious central cabin with several side rooms and a working chimney. I mean,
that's obvious.
It's absolutely ideal for your 19th century eremites.
It's absolutely ideal for you to go in there, lose the tip of your finger and a molar.
Yeah, 50,000 years ago.
Yeah. So there's Neanderthals, Denisovans, and what's the other one?
Well, see, right now, this is where it gets really, really bizarrely...
This is a Tong child.
No, that's much older.
Okay.
It gets really bizarre. It's almost surreally exciting for your average geneticist.
I am quite excited.
Because we have literally no bones for this organism. So if you compare the DNA from a Neanderthal, Homo sapiens, and the Denisovans, we can see interbreeding between Denisovans and Neanderthals, Homo sapiens and Neanderthals, Homo sapiens and Denisovans. Basically a three-way, right? Not at the same time.
Do you know that?
We don't know that. But so what a time to be alive. honestly, we weren't fussy back in the day.
We're not fussy now.
But you see different distributions of those different types of DNA across the world. So Neanderthals were primarily European with a slight bit of Eurasian. So the further, the more white and European you are, the more Neanderthal DNA you'll have in you. Mm-hmm. And the further East Asian you are, the more Denisovan DNA you'll have in you. There was very little what's referred to as backflow of both Denisovan and Neanderthal DNA back into Africa, although there is some, right? What was the question?
What's the third one?
Fourth. So you then compare those four, and the differences between them don't add up, right? So there's a missing contribution that injected DNA, you know, euphemistically, contributed DNA.
We're all adults here.
Well, they're called gene flow events, which I think is one of those brilliant euphemisms. but so there were gene flow. There were clearly gene flow events between something that for which we have no DNA. We have no physical remains. It may be one of the fossils that we know exists but haven't got DNA from. Mm. But there is a phantom species that we carry in our DNA that we don't know what it was.
What do we call it?
It doesn't have a name.
You could name it.
Phantom species.
Can we not name it after somebody that lives in a cave? Yeah.
Homo phantomus. Yeah.
That's very exciting. Yeah. So eventually, are we going to be able to recreate that species?
Well, it's a very...
like Jurassic Park.
People have suggested this seriously. The resurrection species is a little bit like epigenetics, and not unfashionable. It's something that people talk about a lot because it's so attractive as a sort of sci-fi idea. Yeah. I think it's so far from being possible. I think
bollocks is the term you're looking for.
It's not bollocks, though, is it? It's just very, very difficult, and we haven't got the tech.
There's a couple of issues, right? So it's much. I think it's likely that in the next few years we will recreate. We will bring back a species that maybe died in the 20th century.
Like the quagga. Is that how you say it?
Exactly. Yeah. Like I don't know. No, I've written it, but never actually said it.
Anyone know how to pronounce it?
Of course, they're all dead, so you can't ask them.
It is quagga. Or the Thysalanimus?
The cat, the big cat.
Right. Yeah. Now, because they're recently dead and we have good DNA for them, we understand where they fit in evolutionary species terms, we've probably got good models for doing what needs to be done, which is taking a cell from an existing species, synthesizing the DNA from the extinct species, getting the DNA into the cell of the existing species, then getting that into a pregnant female and letting that to develop to term. Now, people have seriously talked about doing this with mammoths, because we have a really decent quality mammoth.
We're going to save the game before we do that, though, right?
Well, this is kind of the point, because what do you get as a result? I mean, apart from the fact that you've got a female elephant giving birth to a different species.
It's really cool.
It's not really cool. It's not. I mean, we don't even know how big a mammoth would be at birth.
Oh.
Okay, so having said all this...
That sounds like a poor lady elephant there having a nasty time.
And you'd be really confused. And also, when the creature is born, it's a bit lost, right? What is my identity as a creature?
Yeah, it's got nothing else it can mate with. You've only got one.
Yeah, its
life is pointless.
That's an argument for making 100. That's not an argument for not doing it. That's just, yeah.
We don't know its environment. We don't know what it fed on. And it becomes a boutique species. It becomes something that can only exist in zoos.
Yeah.
However, having had this conversation on Irish radio a couple of years ago when the mammoth genome was published, I come from a Catholic family, and I was in a discussion with a priest, and there was a point where during the discussion I found myself describing the vaginal tract of an elephant.
Amazing.
And being quite confused that this was happening live on radio. And also being quite confused that I knew so much about the vaginal tract of an elephant. Because it turns out that your average female elephant has about a 7-foot vagina, which has a right angle 2-foot
bend. Right angle?
And the male, the elephant penis, has a prehensile penis, so it can negotiate the
bend. Wow, but then how does the baby elephant get out?
Okay, well, so then they've got a sort of like a hymen. This isn't what we came here to talk about.
No, but it's great. People are looking at it. This is good stuff.
So yeah. Listen, we came here to talk about genetics, which we obviously knew we'd be talking about sex. Continue.
So then there's this sort of enormous membranous sheet, which has a tiny pinprick hole in it, which is also part of the difficulty, the evolutionarily designed difficulty in getting a sperm through it.
Yeah.
You know, vaginas are designed to make getting pregnant as hard as possible. Mm-hmm. So you've got to have a prehensile penis, which is 7 feet long with a bend in it, and then you've got to be able to negotiate it through this 2-millimeter wide hole.
All right, I'm with you so far.
So we know this because artificial insemination has been done in elephants, and so understanding the elephant vaginal tract is important.
You were saying how a baby elephant gets out, and then you're going to go on to mammoths.
Oh, can't we just talk about something else?
Come on.
How does the lady elephant give birth?
Well, through the natural
but like,
way.
But like, are there some muscles that help it round the corner?
Do you know what? Having had this conversation on National Irish Radio with a priest, I've realised I'm well past the limit of my understanding of the subject. I just
God
did eyes.
Damn it. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, let's move on from.
None of that is in my book.
But I'm clearly researching a new novel.
Let's move the conversation on from massive elephant vaginas, not that far, to TV's own Danny Dyer for a moment. Now, people in the audience may be familiar with
prehensile penis,
7 foot long, apparently. People in the audience may be familiar with the aforementioned Danny Dyer's recent appearance on the programme Who Do You Think You Are? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one. That's it. The programme What Do You Think It's Called? Where it turned out, amazingly, Danny Dyer is related both to Thomas Cromwell and Edward III, the former King of England. Danny Dyer, that's amazing, right?
It was a brilliant programme. It was some of the best TV I've seen in a while. I don't watch much TV. But during the course of this hour-long programme, you know that you're familiar with the formats. They take a B-list celebrity and do traditional genealogy and ancestry and trace a line in their ancestry and find out that inevitably they were descended from either a duke or a duchess or a scullery maid. There seemed to be a lot of scullery maids in people's ancestry.
Those sculleries didn't clean themselves.
And they didn't.
No.
But Danny Dyer, who is, I understand, is the current landlord of the Queen Vic in EastEnders, and he did some quite good films when he was young, and then he did a lot of bad films after that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you know, he's a sort of professional Cockney wanker, and anyway, it has this brilliant scene at the... Spoiler alert, I don't care. It's got this brilliant scene at the end when the genealogists reveal on this scroll, this rolled-out family tree, that he's 21 generations directly from Edward III, the first Plantagenet king, you know... This is really significant.
That is amazing. What are the chances?
It's well,
amazing.
It turns out that the chances are 100%.
Oh, okay.
because, thank you for queuing that up for me. because of the way that family trees actually work, which is detailed in the book, but basically... We think about our family trees in very linear ways, and when we trace our ancestry, we tend to only focus on the interesting people and the people for whom there is a paper trail. So mm-hmm. people with you know you can get family records for. Now, of course, in the past, the further you go back in the past, the less likely you are to be someone who has left a physical mark on the mm-hmm. earth, unless you're a royal. Mm-hmm. And so the royal family trees are the ones that we have in immense detail, going back for not just to the 13th century, but for thousands of years. Now, there's a conundrum within family trees, which is that everyone has two parents and four grandparents and eight great-grandparents and so on. So every generation...
Unless there was a cousin marriage involved in there.
That is true, but I do account for this in the maths okay. when I do the maths.
Right. Continue.
So... Now, you still have the same number of ancestors. It's just that they get crammed into fewer people. And that's really the point.
Okay.
So there are more people alive today than there have ever been alive at any single point in history.
Yep.
That's not the same as the myth yep. that there are more people alive now than have ever lived.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on when you start counting, there's been about 107 billion people on Earth, and there are currently obviously about 7 billion. So... if you take one individual, the further back in time you go up their family tree, the more ancestors they have to have. But the conundrum is that at any time in the past, there have been fewer people alive than there are today.
Mm-hmm.
So both of those statements are true. So what you have to do is you have to cram all of your ancestors into fewer people, which means that after a few generations, individuals start occupying multiple places in your family tree. Right? And this is effectively what we call inbreeding. But after a while, you get what's known as pedigree collapse, which is the point at which all your branches of your family tree begin to coalesce and fewer individuals. Now, there is a thing called the... I like to do this with audiences, if you haven't read the book. So the last... we do it just for Europeans, because that's where the data is best known. So the last common ancestor of all Europeans... is
Charlemagne.
You have read the book. No, it's not. It's not Charlemagne, but it's a roundabout.
You're looking for a date.
About 500 years ago, probably somewhere in Germany, there is literally an individual. We don't know who this person was, but the maths declares that there is literally an individual through whom all white people's family trees flow at least once. Right. So that's the last common ancestor.
I'm going to do this face at you. Okay. So I got my DNA analysed, but maybe I just don't count as a white person. I got my DNA analysed because I'm Jewish. So I got my DNA analysed by that 23andMe.
Yeah, so all three of us on this stage have done that. I was going to talk about that earlier, but we can now.
And you know, I come from an Orthodox Jewish family, and as mentioned, and I was like, you know, hoping for something super exciting, like, oh, look, you know, here you've got ancestors from somewhere unexpected. And what I came out with, it's 98% Ashkenazi Jew, 1% Sephardi Jew, and very excitingly, 1% East Asian. So I've got something there to go. So there was some probably Mongol horde or something, or somebody was a trader with Kazakhs or anyway.
Yeah.
But so this cannot be for me, right? That there's that common ancestor. It has.
There's no such thing as Jewish DNA.
What?
Yeah.
What?
On that bombshell.
What?
Yeah.
What?
For exactly these reasons.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you get to a point where you have a most recent common ancestor as an individual, the next interesting genetic point after that, or what before that chronologically, is called the ISA point. And the ISA point is where all lines of all family trees cross through all individuals. Okay, I know that, yes, that face.
Yes, really complicated.
That is the right face. But basically, you can describe it in the reverse way, which is there is a time in history where all the people alive are either the ancestors of everyone alive today or no one alive today.
Okay.
Okay? So that number comes out for Europeans as the 10th century. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you were alive in the 10th century and you have descendants who are alive today, then you were the ancestor of literally everyone who is alive today.
But what about...
This is going back to why it's not so surprising that Danny Dyer is related to Edward III. Because basically we all are.
Yeah, so let me finish off the Danny Dyer story quickly and then we'll talk about the more interesting stuff. So he discovers that he's the 23 generations directly from Edward III, which is factually true, and he can demonstrate this because they've got the family trees to prove it. I did the calculation, and I checked it with a colleague of mine at UCL. And the way I did the calculation is, because it's a royal family tree, you can actually count the number of descendants that Edward III has for about three or four generations. And he was unusually fecund. So he had a lot of descendants. And by the time you get to great-grandchildren, he's up to about 245, which is not totally weird, but it's decent enough. Then you begin to lose track of people because there are just too many. But if you take a simple calculation, which is that on average people who reproduced at that time would have two children, then by the time you get to 1600, then the number of direct descendants of Edward III is around about 20,000. Okay, again, it's a big number, but it's totally plausible. Then you work backwards, right? So you work backwards from 1975, which is the year that Danny Dyer was born, I think, and assuming a generational time of about 25 or 27 years, you count up the number of ancestors that one should have going that far back in time. And it comes out as, I think, 16,000 off the top of my head. And then the population of Britain at this time was about 4.8 million. And then you sort of divide these numbers into each other. I mean, it's not much more complicated than that. And what the number you come up with is that everyone who was born in 1975 should have a maximum number of 118 ancestors who were directly descended from Edward III. And even if you're out by two orders of magnitude, 100, you should still have 8. Okay? So basically, the chances of any ethnically white British person not being descended from Edward III are, I can't remember the exact number, but it was like, P is less significant than, it's like 98th percentile. Basically, the chances are almost all of you are descended from Edward III. and all of you are descended from Charlemagne, because that you go back a further 400 years, and the genetic isopoint has occurred.
But we wouldn't all be descended from Charlemagne if, for example, we were indigenous Australian people.
No, that's true. This is specifically for Europe, and the further from this from Europe you go, the more distant it is. However, the genetic isopoint for everyone on Earth is about 3,500 years ago.
So long after the end of the last ice age.
Ramesses II, we're talking here.
That is not that long ago.
No, it's well into the Old Testament.
Yeah.
It's well into it's halfway through history.
Yeah.
Everyone alive in about...
People had agriculture, they were making alcohol by that point. Yeah, they were doing...
Pyramids.
We had
pretty sophisticated culture.
There was money, there was writing.
Yeah, and there's no one on Earth alive today who is not descended from exactly the same people 3,500, about 1400 BC. So you're right to point out that Charlemagne only works for most of Europe. You know, sometimes people of East Asian descent say, my ancestor was Genghis Khan. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Because everyone west of the steppes.
Yeah. I mean, I figure if I've got 1% East Asian, I've got some Genghis Khan, which I can feel in myself.
But the point about your Jewishness is that...
My fake Jewishness.
It's not fake. It's just that what we're talking about here is the proportion of DNA which is common in different self-identifying ethnic groups. Now, Ashkenazism is a sort of medieval... it emerges as a medieval phenomenon within Judaism, and it accounts for about 2/3 of Jews the world over.
Yep.
Now, there is no group of people on Earth who have managed to keep it within their own group for any length of time, any significant length of time. The highest is probably the Saracens.
Huh.
So the Saracens who live on a mountain in...
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, but they've had to start outbreeding because they're so inbred that they can't reproduce. So not even then. There are no islands in the South Pacific where there hasn't been gene flow from external parties. India's quite interesting because they've been... Indians have been practicing caste for about 2,000 or 3,000 years now. And that is a class structure which does, endogamy is the term for it, where you are breeding only within a social structure. And we do see certain genetic traits emerging within castes and not in other castes. But still, chapter one of the book is called Horny and Mobile.
Yeah.
Because that's what people are, right? No one can keep it together for more than a few generations. So, you know, my stepmom, her father was an orphan raised by the Sisters of Mercy in Liverpool, not the band. Because that would have been awesome. No, by some Sisters of Mercy in Liverpool. And we didn't know much about his father, apart from his name. And Liverpool being a port town, he was called John Adams. And then when we started looking a couple of years ago, he wasn't called John Adams. He was called Joseph Abrahamson. And he was an Orthodox Russian Jew.
Yeah.
Right. Now, the casualness with which people can abandon decades or hundreds of years of ancestry, just gone like that. And in fact, there are thousands of examples of Jewish people in this country who have names like K-A-Y, and G-G-E, and Cohen, who are called those things because, well, in the first two examples, because immigration officials couldn't spell Kuplinski or something beginning with G, yeah. Or because Cohen, well, you're Jewish, you're probably called Cohen. Mm-hmm. I actually had a brilliant moment of, it's not mansplaining if you're talking to another man, is it? It's just patronising. Yeah. A friend of mine called Cohen, Andrew Cohen, and I said, so you're a Cohen? And he said, well, no. And I said, well, if you're a Cohen, you're directly descended from the Cohenim.
Yeah.
You know, the paternal branch of high Jewish priests. And he went, no. And I said, yes. And he said, no. We were given the name Cohen in the 19th century because my Czechoslovakian ancestors had a complicated name that no one knew.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so when I did the 23andMe, and they obviously, not having read my novels, nonetheless were able to detect through my spit sample that I am an Ashkenazi Jew, they were doing that because my sample is very similar to a lot of other people who also call themselves Ashkenazi Jews.
That's right.
Yeah.
So there isn't a way, there is no scientific method for determining where people's ancestors come from.
Yeah.
Using DNA. That doesn't exist. And these tests, which we've all had done, and I expect some of you have had them done as well, are interesting. I think they're quite trivial. I don't think they really tell you anything profound.
They're a sort of posh, expensive version of a horoscope.
I'm not going to say specifically about specific companies, but I describe them as genetic astrology in the book. And some are better than others.
But they are really fun.
23andMe, I think, is a credible company. I think Ancestry.com is a credible company. Others, less so. But like I said, there isn't a scientific method for telling you where your DNA comes from in the past. What they tell you is where people on Earth today have similar DNA to you. So to be reducto ad absurdum, if 2% of my DNA says, according to my map, comes from Sweden, right? Now, having a parent who is Northern European, that's hardly surprising. It could be that everyone in Sweden moved there on January the 16th, 1975, and that is where, the day I was born, and that is where that DNA comes from. It could be that they'd been there and they hadn't moved for the last 10,000 years. It's not. Everyone wants to discover that they're actually Viking. Right, you are. You're Viking. You have Viking ancestors. That'll be £160, please. You have Jewish ancestors. You have Jewish and Viking and Saracen and French and Norwegian and African and probably Chinese ancestors.
That's very exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. It's super cool. It's also just. It's just kind of like trivial.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I know it is true that there's no such thing really as Jewish genes in the sense that when you go to India, there are Indian Jews who, you know, appear Indian. And so it's not like, oh, look, these are people who have, you know, just been like intermarriage between us. You know, then that's the case with Jewish populations all over the world. Gosh, it's very easy to stray into saying something that sounds a bit racist.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, I can only apologise if that just sounded a bit racist. I don't know where to go from that. Somebody else make a joke.
No, it's quite difficult to make to write on this topic. Chapter four is called race.
Yeah, but what you're saying is actually race is a social construct and not a genetic thing.
Or is it?
Yes. Yeah. Well, careful. Yes.
It also doesn't help, Adam, that your entire industry was basically founded by massive racists for the purposes of racism.
That is precisely right. Yeah. That is my direct intellectual genesis. Yeah.
But surely you're descended from all the different kinds of intellectual heritage across the world.
Well, actually, family trees and
see, I made a joke.
Family trees and academia is much more linear, much more easy to understand. But I was an undergraduate in the Galton Laboratory, where I still have an honorary fellowship. And Galton was Darwin's cousin, and he was the founder of
racism.
No, racism has been around for ages. He was the founder of genetics.
Right.
So his experiments and he was a brilliant statistician. He was a brilliant scientist in many, many ways. He was also a racist and quite an unpleasant person in many regards. His scientific legacy is unquestionably important. But the irony of... So let me just deal with the question. I argue in the book, and I think I'm right, that as a scientific term... The value for the way we colloquially talk about race has no value for science. There is no way of breaking up people genetically using DNA that corresponds to the way we talk about people when we use terms like race. And there are many examples I can give. Well, there are all the examples that I go through a few in the book, and there are obvious ones, such as Jewishness is one. So in 1882 and 84, two doctors, one in London, one in New York, Tay and Sachs, separately identified a condition in young Jewish boys, which became known as Tay-Sachs disease.
Which, if you are a Jewish person, you get tested for when you're a teenager, and then you've got to go and tell because it's a terrible genetic disorder, and it's muscle wasting, isn't it?
It's a neurological disorder which involves muscle wasting as well. It's a single mutation in a gene called HexA, and it's awful. It's an awful, awful condition. It was identified in these two Jewish families. You see the emergence of recessive genetic disorders in families that have high degrees of consanguinity inbreeding in them anyway. But within a few years, and it became known as the Jewish disease. Now, at this time in history, this is we're in a period where the anti-Semitism is going to crescendo in 1945, right? So it becomes...
But maybe again in the future.
Well, looking that way...
looking good for a resurgent. Continue.
Wow, nobody laughed at that.
No.
Reality sucks.
Yeah, I'm really sorry about
anyway,
that.
Anyway, so a couple of years later, the same disease is identified in a non-Jewish family, and it gets labelled something different, because it can't be the same disorder, because these guys aren't Jewish.
That's brilliant.
So, through the course of the 20th century, we identified Tay-Sachs at similar proportions in all sorts of populations around the world, Cajuns, Canadians, French, at the same sort of levels that occurs within Jewish families. So it's quite clear that it isn't exclusive to Jews at all. And ironically, because there are more Jewish geneticists
Jewish culture is very interested in education. That is a cultural trait of Jewish culture.
Yeah.
And therefore, we end up with a lot of people who are highly educated, and many of them go into science, and some of those become geneticists.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
That was very handy. Thank you for getting me out of that hole. As a result of that, exactly as you've just described, Tay Sachs now doesn't exist in Jewish populations because of a proactive recognition that it was a disease of inbreeding and consanguinity. And so through what we might refer to as soft eugenics, it has effectively been bred out of the population that it was originally discovered in. Right? So it's a great example of how we begin to understand how inheritance patterns actually work. Actually, you know, the earliest description of inheritance patterns that are effectively genetics is in the Talmud. And it's a description in one particular tract where it describes how if your son bleeds to death on circumcision, and if the mother has a sister whose first two sons also did, then the second and third sons from the first woman are exempt from circumcision. Mm. So there's a very small proportion of Jewish boys who are not circumcised. And what they're describing there is hemophilia. Right?
Yeah.
So that's 3,000 years old worth of...
brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
We're getting to the point where we're running quite late, and I do want to take some questions from the audience, but I did also promise that there was going to be some sort of discussion of sci-fi, so perhaps if you guys want to think about something like that. But just to finish us off, I just want to... I'll start with the question that got sidelined by genital chat then, which I wanted to kick off discussion of sci-fi, which is, Adam... I think this is in the book. It might just be something you've told me, or it might have been in the early book or something. But at some point, you've been on some radio chat show, and the interviewer has said, "So, Adam, when will human beings be able to fly?"
When were human beings last able to fly?
Well, on aeroplanes today.
we did that.
So it was. The story was, and this is true. I do TV work, and I was asked to go for lunch with a TV producer because they wanted to make what's known as a support program for a major TV series. It was Heroes. Do you remember Heroes?
Yeah.
The first season was quite good, and then it went a bit wrong.
Fell off a cliff, that show.
Yeah, I thought the first season was excellent, actually.
First season was excellent, and the second season fell off a cliff. We could do a whole evening on why that happened.
Yeah. And then they've just relaunched it, but I don't think anyone watched it.
I mean...
It was basically the X-Men, right? If you didn't see Heroes, it was basically the X-Men.
But it wasn't about anything, whereas X-Men is really about something.
Yeah, civil rights.
Yeah.
It's about racism, isn't it?
Yeah,
the X-Men, basically.
I mean, do you know this, that in the X-Men, Professor X is based on Martin Luther King, or like that's the sort of concept, and Magneto is supposed to be Malcolm X. So it's like those thoughts about how do you respond to a society that has treated you appallingly? Do you say, no, I dream that one day we will be able to live together? Or do you go, no, fuck those fuckers. Separatism, you know, there's like now that we don't have to be afraid of them anymore, just they're never going to be kind to us. Let's just get out of here. And yeah, sorry,
all Marvel comics are about.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
well, and also the X-Men movies, which, you know, Bryan Singer is a gay Jew, and it's kind of about that same thing, I think, of like, well, you know, here we are now, quite a. Like, you know, we have, maybe you feel like, oh, I have quite a lot of influence in the world or something. And then how do you feel about people who would have wanted to kill you at some earlier point? Anyway, I love the X-Men. Carry on.
It's almost as if, like, science fiction is about something else.
Right. Okay. Oh, yeah. I know what it was. So the X-Men is about something, but Heroes
was not
about anything. Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
The point was that they wanted to do a program on BBC 3 or 4 about the real science behind... Heroes, right? You know, superpowers, genetic superpowers, do they really exist? And so the opening gambit for this meal was, so tell me, when are humans going to be able to evolve to be able to fly? And I thought, oh God, here we go. I'm going to give it my best smiley face because it's work.
Yeah.
You know? and went into this sort of impassioned description of how evolution works, but also that, you know, the real significance to human evolution is that we are a technological species. And the energy constraints and the reasons for evolving wings are not something which are conceivable within our current understanding of evolution. But what we did as our brains got bigger and the so-called cognitive revolution 50,000 years ago, is we embraced technology in a way that would be, you know, I went on and on like this. It's all in the book, right? You know, I don't need to bore you with this kind of stuff. But it was a sort of impassioned, and I was watching these two guys, and there was a point where they nodded at each other. And they were thinking, I read them as thinking, yeah, this is the guy. Right? And I'm into comics, and I was making references to comics, and I was talking about how, you know, there are blind people who can echolocate.
Yes, there are.
But not like Daredevil.
Yeah, clicks like that, no.
Not quite as good as Matt Murdock can do it. But nevertheless, I was saying, you know, so the actual answer is, well, you know, we can fly. We invented this stuff. We used our evolved brains to invent the technology so we could do all of these amazing things because humans are amazing. And they went, yes, brilliant. So you think it'll be about 200 years? I was like, yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks for the pizza. Yeah.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.